Okay, let's get going. Welcome. I'm glad everybody made it today. The obligatory, any questions or comments? I did send out a bunch of news items today, and those are for you to look over. These are things that are in the news that I find that may be of interest, and there are several interesting developments that I passed along, and I'll talk about one a little bit later. So Thursday we're having a tour of the spinal cord injury, and I have the carpooling sign up sheet. So there are four people that have cars that are willing to take passengers, and so please sign up if you need a ride. Include your cell phone number and if possible, if you're driving a car, where you'd like people to meet you, and I'll pass this around by email as well. So in case you don't figure out who's in what car, you'll know. So also, another important thing is a map. I have maps to the facility, and they look a lot like this. So so Stanford is like over here, and you come down Unipero Serra, and it turns into Foothill over here. You pass Page Mill, make a left at Hillview, and then an immediate right on Miranda, and the VA is right there. And here's the description. If you get lost or late, just give me a call, and I'll try to guide you in. And here's what the VA looks like. So here's the main entrance, and it has the American flag over here. So this is where you turn in, and there's all sorts of parking over here, and there's even some parking over here now. And basically your destination is this corner of the Spinal Cord Injury Center, Building 7. And once you find that corner, go in through the automatic doors, and the room will be the first one on the right, E111. So we'll convene there and have a little some introductory remarks by our host, Graham Creasy, who is the chief of spinal cord injury there. Then he'll show us around the clinic. I don't think there'll be a lot of people using the clinic at that time because it's sort of late in the day. But you get an idea of some of the equipment they'll use, and he'll describe that. And then we'll probably come back to this room and have Dr. Creasy will give a little bit of a presentation, and we'll have a little bit of discussion. Last year when we did that, it worked out really, really well. I should mention, you know, that he's a very busy guy, and so we owe him a lot to host our class there. So please, if you can be there, it's going to be great. How many people are planning to attend? Yeah. Okay, great. I think we can accommodate everybody. Your community members are welcome to attend. I need to know who you are so I can get a good idea of you know who's coming in case people get lost. Okay. I will be taking photos, so if you can't make it on Thursday and want to get a feel for some of the equipment, I'll post the pictures on the course website. And I'm going to try to walk around with the wireless receiver for the microphone, so to capture the audio as well. So okay. Let's start some of the discussion going here. And so this is one I did last year as well. So actually, this is a part of a Twilight Zone or Outer Limits one. So I saw it when I was a kid. It was very scary. So woman is in a car accident and she has facial disfigurement. Do you think facial disfigurement is in itself a disability? What do you think? Yes or no? Yes?
It depends how it affects you.
Okay. If it's just appearance, what would you say?
I mean how it affects you emotionally.
Okay.
I think so
there
is...
Right. So there's an emotional component to disability is what you're saying. Even if the disfigurement is slight, it's up to the individual to determine how it affects them. Right. And there's certainly, you know, functional aspects too. If you get a disfigurement that, you know, prevents you from chewing or whatever, that's another issue. So she has plastic surgery and when the bandages are removed, she appears beautiful. Is that person disabled or not? Well, again, you know, if it's appearance-wise, the appearance part is taken away, but there could be some latent emotional component, right? You know, going through the stress of the accident. So the last scene in the program shows her beautiful face, and then all the doctors and everybody else in the room all have the same facial disfigurement. So now she's in a society where everybody else is disfigured except her. So how does that change your perception of her disability? Victor, do you have any?
She must have been more disabled, right? Because she stands out.
Yeah.
Depends. I mean, our perception of what is like not good looking or like correct. It depends on like what is the baseline.
Yeah, for society, you know, what's the norm?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. So I try to. There's a lot of pictures of facial disfigurement, but I think this was the best one to put up. So, Phantom of the Opera. So was he disabled? Well, he certainly was hiding away from society because, you know, he thought so low of himself. So there's that issue there. So, anybody else have comments? Scary stuff. Okay, this is one I like. Superman. Well, we all know Superman is super, right? Unless he's sitting next to Kryptonite. So how does that apply to, you know, our world? I mean, this is comic world, but it actually has application in everyday things. Is there any situation that you can think of where at one moment you're perfectly able-bodied and the next moment you feel like totally disabled or stuff like that? Elaine, I see you're nodding your head.
Yeah, the drugs don't work.
So the drug is the anti-kryptonite?
Pretty much.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yes. People might be in water. Like people aren't very good at swimming.
Ah. Okay. So if you're in an environment that is sort of disabling, and you can't swim, so yeah. Mike, did you have a comment?
The first one I thought, like you said, and I saw that Twilight Zone show.
Oh, good. Good. Wasn't that scary?
It was very freaky, and I would say that the girl, even though she was gorgeous, was severely disabled.
Right, yeah.
She was severely disabled in that movie. The fact that everybody else was so deformed, they looked okay, and she looked so okay, she was disabled.
Right.
Hard to explain, but it was just the society.
That's right. There was another one that I remember now where... there was this isolated village, and everybody in the village, because of the water, somehow all became blind. And so, do you remember that one, Wayne? Yeah, right. So.
And I think there was a gentleman who came in and could see.
That's right. Somebody from the outside came in and was able to see, but he toward the end he himself got blind as well.
I think the way the story went,
okay.
They didn't believe them. They thought he was delusional.
Ah.
Mental or emotional.
Oh,
right. Their eyes had disappeared from non-use. So he says, these growths that he has in the socket area, he says, we need to operate and cut them out.
To make you normal.
Right, that's what they want.
Yeah, that's great. So can anybody there's a lot of situations where, you know, one moment you're on the go, and the next moment, you know, you're disabled. You know, what if you break your leg? Okay, that's a sort of disabling condition, you know. But last year a person said, you know, what about an allergy? You know, you could be perfectly okay, and then you could be allergic to something, and all of a sudden you become totally, you can't do anything. You're sneezing, you know, you can't function. So, you know, that an allergy is a form of, you know, being, you know, with kryptonite. Reed?
It's just like getting sick or something.
Right. Yeah, would you consider yourself disabled if you're sick? Well, temporarily.
Temporarily.
Yeah, right.
It's the same with the credit matters, that you can be temporarily disabled.
Right. Okay, that's good. Yeah. Okay. Okay, third one. So we have a child that's of ethnic descent. I'm not going to tell you where she is, what country it is. That doesn't really matter. But, you know, because of the community where she lives, you know, it could be segregated or poor or remote or, you know, in an earthquake zone or something. You know, she can't get an education. You know, she might have potential. She may be really smart and motivated, and she could be like a leader on something. But because of her living situation, you know, she... Can't assert her potential. So, would you consider that a disability? Cultural thing, environment, right? So, I mean, thinking back to our definition of disability, it's a health related situation. So, this isn't really health related; it's more society or environment related, but. But you know, not being able to live up to your potential, you know, seems sort of disabling. Well, it's pretty much a bad situation. So it's there's a lot of
more disadvantaged, I would say.
Yeah, more disadvantaged.
More disabling situation.
Like
you're saying, kryptonite is a situation.
Right. Yeah, but that's the kryptonite could be very temporary, but this could be like you can't get out of the situation. Yeah. Yeah, Maury.
United Cerebral Palsy Association made a movie to prove a point. The movie was a building that was set up for wheelchairs. Everyone working in the building was in wheelchairs, so there were no chairs at the desks. Everything was low and so forth. So an able-bodied person goes in there, and they're disabled.
Ah, right. So you bring up a good point. You know, a lot of our structures that are around us are built for able-bodied people, and it seems like, you know, it's just been an afterthought that we've tried to be more inclusive and get other people in. But, you know, we can create disabilities for others by the way we arrange society, not only by buildings but by, you know, accessing information and, you know, having cars and stuff like that. So these are all part of you know, how we live and the choices that society has made. Okay, great. Thanks a lot. So, as I said, Thursday we're going to be going over to the VA, and that's what Dr. Creasy looks like. And he's been around for only the past 3 or 4 years. So, but he's the chief of spinal cord injury there, and there's a lot of folks that go through the center there getting rehabilitation, and there's a few people that actually live at the VA as well. So I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of people there, but we will see the facility. So there ought to be a good event on Thursday. Okay. So today we have Mike Norell. But before I introduce him, I want to I sent out a little news item about this issue of Fast Company. They have a whole article in here about prosthetics and orthotics, and that coupled with that National Geographic article that I showed you a few weeks ago, you can see that this prosthetics and orthotics stuff is in the headlines. It's current stuff. So
So, you know, it starts out by saying, by posing the question, what advantage does having a leg amputee give you? And the answer is it cuts your pedicure expenses in half. So that's how the article starts. So please check that out. It's written by a fellow at MIT that actually has two artificial legs. So Mike Norell is a prosthetist, orthotist, and he owns his own business called, coincidentally, Norell Prosthetics Orthotics. And he's been working with human technology for 40 years, and he has a background in the military, in the Navy, and Marine Corps, specializing in field medicine. That's where he got his start in this, I guess. And he has a human biology degree from Cal State Hayward, and he was enrolled in the prosthetic orthotic program at the UCLA School of Medicine. And he's going to be talking about prosthetics and orthotics, as well as some medical missions that he's about to embark on, where he's going to be making custom prosthetic devices on site. So please help me in welcoming Mike Norell.
I'll switch over.
Laser pointer, and here it is forward. And here's your water.
Good, perfect, everything. Thank you again, Dave. Again, I want to thank Dave, Professor Drew, for inviting me to come out and talk about something I'm very passionate about. That's prosthetics and orthotics. Again, a little bit of my background, as Dave touched on. Both my parents are in the medical field. My mother was an Army nurse, and my father was a Navy corpsman chief over at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital.
My experience is, again,
military medical. When I was with the Navy at Balboa Naval Hospital, it was more of a hospital. When I was more with Camp Pendleton and the Marines, it was more of field medicine.
I did that for a few years,
traveled a lot of different places with the Marines, did a lot of jungle training, foul weather training, desert training. They throw all this into your medical training to see how well you can adapt to it. So we have a lot of experience doing that.
When I got out of school again, went to school for probably the next eight years or so, just focusing on human biology and medicine, and that's what got me to where I am here today. First thing I would like to talk about is the prosthetics and orthotics, is the overview, what the word means, what exactly the word orthotic means. We'll go over a little bit of history, some devices, challenges of the disabled that I find out that relates to my practice a lot, so I'd like to give out that information. Emerging technologies in the field, and then some final thoughts and some pictures of some of the stuff I do overseas. First thing I'd like to talk about again, these two words get interchanged quite a bit, and it's not just the lay people. I have doctors that do it. I have
physical therapists that do it.
These names aren't interchangeable. Prosthetics means to replace or replacing, and orthotics is related to straightening or to straighten. And so naturally, prosthetics would be artificial limbs, and where orthotics would be more of a bracing people. A little bit more about my family. The Norell family has been building functional external fixators since the late 1950s. Again, my father was at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital. They had a lot of research over there in the late 50s, early 60s, and he was part of that program. He started out as an operating room technician and eventually went into the prosthetics after the wars and everything. What you'll find out, too, is that the wars caused a lot of technology for prosthetics and orthotics. Every time there is a big war, there is a streamload of technology coming right in behind it. So
I'm expecting that we're going to have a lot of technology coming up, and especially upper extremities and as well as lower extremities. I first got started in the late 60s when I was in high school. My father needed a technician, so I would go over during the summer and make some fabricating devices, polyvinyl alcohol bags, P-Lite liners, all these things for fabricating prosthetics that now you can pull off the shelf. We actually had to fabricate in the 60s. There's a few programs that will give you degrees in prosthetics. There's a couple technician programs. I believe there's four of them. One's in Spokane. I think California State Dominguez Hills also has a technician program. As far as I know right now, there's only 9 universities that actually will offer a practitioner program. The closest one to us will be the Dominguez Hills. We used to have one at UCLA. They lost their grants, so the school no longer exists. But the California State University Dominguez Hills is a very good program. You can get your bachelor's degree there, or you can do a post-bachelor practitioner degree there. Another thing that we talk about a lot in prosthetics and orthotics are bony landmarks. That is our engineering reference points. We can't do anything without them. We know we have a mirror image on the other side, so if we know that there's a bone or a prominent or a concavity on one side, we're probably going to have it on the other side, and that will help us measure and build these prosthetic devices. Again, bony landmarks are distinguishing features found on the bones of the skeletal system. You'll have either one or two of these distinguishing marks on the bone, and these are used regularly by therapists, prosthetists, orthotists, doctors, physiatrists, podiatrists. A lot of people need to use these marks for references to find out how to build human engineering products. Again, here's a bigger list of all of them. Again, we use them all. You can see up here at the top. Up here at the top where it has a sternal notch, a lot of our braces that come up high on the throat will not go beyond the sternal notch up there. It'll have to be a little bit below it. If you're ever measuring for hips, the anterior superior iliac spine will give you a good measurement of that. Again, palpating some of these bony areas. Greater trochanter will help you give a length of a leg. Down here, right down here, is the tibial tubercle and the patellar tendon. And the patellar, where we actually put weight on a below knee prosthesis, which is a very important measurement to have as well. Again, all these lists of bony landmarks, again, we pretty much use them all in making braces and prosthetics for patients. It's estimated that one out of every 200 people has some kind of amputation, according to the ACA, or the Amputee Coalition of America. Again, it could be a partial foot, or it could be something elaborate as an electric arm. But this is why there is a need for prosthetics and orthotics in the country.
Is that in the U.S. or the entire world?
I believe it's in the entire world. Life challenges, again, historically man's challenge through life has been accompanied by trauma, disease, and congenital abnormalities, and these are directly associated with the need for prosthetics and orthotics. These three things, trauma, disease, and congenital abnormalities, are probably the three main reasons why I'm making prosthetics right now. Believe it or not, I would say probably 15, 20 years ago, 80% of my patients were disease. The others were trauma and congenital. I'm guessing now that disease has increased at least 5%. So I'm saying now probably 85% of my patients are from disease or diabetes or some type of circulatory problem. Now when I go overseas to the Philippines, it's the complete opposite, where trauma is probably 85% of what I'm seeing over there. But it's very troublesome, the fact that I think a lot of this could be controlled by diet, exercise, and a lot of other things. Of course, some of these people just to have the genes that cause all this, but some of this could be prevented as well. A little bit about the history of prosthetics and orthotics is, we know that for sure that the blacksmiths and the armor makers probably the first orthotists that we've had. And as we had more detail and more problems with this, It went more toward the shipbuilders and the metal workers so they could develop more detailed devices for us. The history of prosthetics goes way back, as you can see, 3500 to 1800 BC. The first recorded prosthesis was found in a book from Vedas written in Sanskrit, India, and I think they call it Rig Vedas, was one of the earlier books. But there was a Queen Vishpa who went out to battle, lost her leg, and for her to get back in battle, they built her a leg made of iron to where she could return to battle and fight. Apparently quite a gal, because she still trampled around with the men after this amputation, which was quite incredible. Not as further down, but Herodotus wrote about a Persian prisoner who actually cut his foot off while he was in stocks. They said later he made himself as a wooden leg and got around with that, but he released himself from the wooden stocks. Other history, I believe in the middle 1800s, they found some fabricated orthoses. They could have been from fracture braces or some type of injury, and that was way back, found out that was 2500 BC. Yes?
Yeah, there was a recent story about a hiker who was hiking alone, and he had a big rock fall on him, and he had to amputate his own hand. So you might remember that.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah. Incredible. And he was quite the survivor, because he was out there for a couple of days, I believe, too, with that problem. Evolution of prosthetic devices. Again, there was a lot of history. In 1550, there was a famous surgeon, Ambrose Perry. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But he was the first surgeon to did ligation for surgeries. He also was one of the first prosthetists. He made a hand with a stationary thumb with spring-loaded fingers, and this was in 1550. It was quite incredible. And from that, that's where the prosthetic hands took off. And they weren't just prosthetic, too. I believe that there was a German dentist who actually rigged up the cable system in the early 1800s. And his name was Banliff, I think, Peter Banliff. And then from that, 40, 50 years later, there was a sculptor who actually did the cable to release the elbow and flex the elbow. So they weren't just prosthetists. They may have had friends or family or even themselves that had these problems where they were ingenious enough to rig out cable systems and all these other things to help operate the arms and the hands of prosthetics. And you can see these early prosthetic devices. These could probably be coming from the medieval times. The remarkable thing about the medieval times, they weren't putting on these prosthetics for function as much as they were trying to conceal their weaknesses. So a lot of times they wanted to go back into war because of the fighters they were, but they didn't want people to know that they were missing arms, missing legs, things like that. So they would conceal them with these things, which later they tried to make them a little bit more functional. Turn of the breakthroughs, since I've been doing prosthetics, the 1960s, again, I was making a lot of stuff then that they can pull off the shelf now. They're getting a little bit more into the biomechanics of the development of the material and devices. They just came out with the Satch foot maybe 10, 15 years before that. I think UC Berkeley was involved with the making of the solid ankle cushion heel foot, which is probably the first foot that actually came out that was a norm for the profession. Before that, they were just putting on whatever they could, iron, wood, whatever they could to find underneath them. The Satch foot, I believe, in the 40s or 50s was the true pure starting point of feet for prosthetics. In the 1970s, I started realizing that we weren't doing a lot of the thermal setting as much as we're doing the thermal forming plastics now. So this was a pretty good breakthrough because it sure took a lot less time to actually vacuum form these than to actually put the resin through a PVA bag and set them off. So that was pretty good technology for us. Again, through development of this, we found out that Kevlar was too rigid, but it was pretty strong. Carbon was really flexible, and fiberglass, again, pretty rigid. It started coming down to through these three materials is what I usually design my prosthetics with, and eventually I got rid of the Kevlar, got rid of the fiberglass, and now we're strictly carbon legs. The 1980s, again, newer material, more carbon graphite, more technology in the feet, more diving board type feet versus just cushion heel type feet, and everything's starting to take off now. Georgia Tech, I believe, offered the first entry-level graduate degree program in prosthetics, and that happened in the 1990s. To give you an idea of how primitive this field was, and it's just starting to grow. I want to talk a little bit about prosthetic feet now and the history of them. Again, in the 1940s, 1950s, at UC Berkeley and the Veterans Administration were involved with designing this foot. It was called a Satch foot. Normally, every single amputee at that time did get this foot, and basically all it is a solid ankle with a cushion heel. So it's a rubber foot with a cushion heel. The problems we had with this foot, after we used it quite a bit, was the fact that each person had a different weight category. So if you were very light, the heel seemed too rigid, and if you were very heavy, the heel just seemed too soft. So us as prosthetists would have to go in and take that heel out and replace it with our own durometer heel. It could be a firmer heel or a softer heel to adjust this. What would happen with that is we pretty much destroyed the foot a lot of times when we pulled these heels out, which probably led to the technology of a single axis foot, which again is on a swivel. It rolls pretty good. What we found out with this too is the above knee amputees could walk a lot better in a single axis design. The fact that they wouldn't get so much pressure coming down from the force of the leg. It broke up some of the resistance and seemed to be a pretty effective foot. Problem with the single axis foot as well as the multi-axis foot, which is also a very good design, and that was also a series of bumpers, was that these feet were too heavy, and we had to get into something lighter. That brought up the strengths of the energy-storing foot and later on to the flex foot. And here are some, the five pictures of the five primary feet that prosthetists use right now. Again, here is the Satch foot, solid ankle cushion feel. Looks pretty real, but this back here is where we actually had to cut a diamond out to relieve that heel and put in the new heel pressures. Eventually down the road, in the next few years, they actually had different Satch feet with different heel durometers, so you could order the one you wanted. But when we started out with the standard one, and we as prosthetists would have to replace that heel. Here's a picture of that prosthetic foot with a single axis. You got the rigid heel, got the rubber bumper right down here to cushion it as it rotated up and down. The multi-axis foot here, we had the bumper here, the bumper in the front. And what we could do with these bumpers is interchange them, put a more dense bumper down here for less firmness, or vice versa on the bumper in the front. So we can adjust these bumpers to get the speed or the gait that we needed. Now, after we found out that these were way too heavy, we went into this flexible keel. Now, the nice thing about this, it had a Delron keel from here to here. And that would actually give your toes some spring. The problem with this foot during the first early stages of it, as we'd break down right here on the ball because the rubber that we were using was always not strong enough to take on the Delron keel on the bottom. Through years and years of research, I think they actually kind of figured that out. But by then, the flex foot started coming into play to where that was a more dynamic foot. It's like having a diving board on the end of your prosthesis, and as you pushed, it stored energy and pushed you back. This is quite an incredible breakthrough for prosthetics, and this is actually the type of foot that we are using today, and there's different variations of it. Now we're going to do a little history of socket designs. This is our above-knee socket designs. Early in the 20th century, we used to do plug sockets and wood sockets, and basically the whole idea behind these was grab some of the soft tissue on the top and try to hang on to that socket. It usually wasn't very effective, so what we'd have to do is actually put a pelvic band and a waist belt over the top of that to really help hang that prosthesis on you. A quadrilateral socket was the next design, and basically that's four-wall socket. The key thing for the quadrilateral socket is your tailbone was actually on the outside of the socket and you were sitting on that wall. to where the ischial ramo containment sockets, they put the ischium or that tailbone into the socket, and when they did that, they found out they had a lot more control of the socket. So the design from a plug socket to the quadrilateral suction socket to the ischial ramial containment sockets, all these are different stages and trying to get, again, more stabilization in an above-knee prosthetic patient and just more comfort. These, again, are the design. This is the plug socket here with the waist belt. Try to get an airplane version of a quadrilateral socket. Again, here's the posterior wall where the person would actually sit on. This would be the inside wall here. This is the outside wall here. And, of course, here's the front where we put a lot of pressure on these three muscles that keep you on that seat in the back. This other socket here is more of what the ischial containment. It's a lot higher on the outside. If you turn this socket around the inside, you can see it's a lot more undercut on the inside. The tailbone will actually, instead of fitting on the outside wall here, it'll actually will go inside the socket. Before we get into emerging technology, I want to show you a couple of advances in below knee prosthetics, and I brought one of my friends here, Chuck, to demonstrate three different types of below knee, how to suspend prosthetics. The first one that I think that he has on is a patellar tendon bearing cuff strap. So a lot of times on these below knee amputees, this is Chuck here, a lot of the times on these below knee amputees, they get rested on this patellar tendon notch in the front, and their AP, or the anterior posterior measurement, had to be a particular dimension so they could be suspended up, because if you hit a bottom on the prosthesis, you will not wear the leg. So we really have to suspend these up. So most of our below knee prosthetic patients cannot hit bottom, but they need contact on the bottom. If they don't get the contact on the bottom, they can get the stuff called verrucous hyperplasia, which is not very good. Basically, it's a swelling of the leg, a scaling of the leg, and sometimes an oozing of the leg, and it's not very good. So a lot of patients have this reaction if they do not get contact. So you do need contact on the end, but you don't tolerate a lot of pressure. Chuck?
All the weight is on my knee. Anytime I get pressure on the bottom, then I take it off. It's like pins and needles at the bottom of your feet. The trick to these things is they've got to fit snug, and then any movement, any discomfort, any banging, anything, that'll determine what type of day you're going to have. But I've been wearing these on and off for 35 years. I lost mine in an industrial accident. Actually pinned in a bear, and when they turned it on, it actually pinched my foot off. And I got back on my feet in less than 4 months. I started walking in 10 months. My original one was the Satch foot. The Satch foot's a real heavy. The very first prosthetics weighed close to like 5 pounds, mind you.
Yeah.
The ones that they're developing now weigh about a pound and a half. I still play softball. I can run. I can't run as fast as I used to. I know my limitations on each prosthetic that I wear. I've tried skiing. I plan on trying snowboarding this year. There's no limitations on what you can do. I go through these prosthetics and probably I'll chew one up in about a year. I'm so active.
Yeah.
I'll sit down with Mike and we'll come up with something new.
Show him the design on how that's suspended. What Chuck has, he's got what they call a cuff strap. So,
this one's a strap. Okay.
And so what that does is actually fastening on by a cuff suspension strap that will come around the back of the leg, and that basically holds it on from the top of the knee.
I like this because, you know, when I'm practicing kicking or something, I can spin it, and I feel more secure it's going to stay on. This other one that Mike designed for me, this is the one I wear for softball. It's a lot lighter. It's got this has the Renegade foot. It's the same one that Neil Perry wears from San Jose State that plays football. When I run with this one, it seems more natural than running with the one that I'm wearing right now. It's very light. You're more welcome to check them out.
compared to the original, which I got there about 3.5 to 5 pounds.
Yeah.
That one right there, I can beat it to death. I can drive a car over it. Well, that's light compared to a lot of them. And I wear a completely different type liner with that. I wear a silicone liner here with a release pin. This pin here anchors it in, and I have a release button. When I want to take it out and push it, release it, and it pops right out.
Yeah, it's a shuttle lock design. As soon as it goes in, it click, 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 and locks them right in there.
Yeah, so when I'm running, I don't have that piston action. I can do it with a strap.
Yeah.
That one there,
yeah, and then like this one here has no straps, but this one is actually suspended above the bones of the knee. It's called supercondylar suspension. So we have this inside liner here that's a lot tighter, and as you can see, a lot more thickness on the top here. And as you go into this, it actually locks you into your condyles above your knee, and those are what's actually holding you onto the leg. It's called P-Lite. It's like a rubber, a moldable rubber that we've been using for a long time in the industry. But again, carbon braid is a very interesting technique, because if you do just a regular carbon, you can shatter, it can chip. But if you do a carbon braid, it's like electricity. You can run over it with a truck. If it doesn't shatter, it doesn't do anything. So it's pretty strong stuff. Well, we first of all, I get the cast and get the mold. And then from that, I get the positive, so I pour the mold and get the positive. And then I know also that it can't take too much pressure on the bottom. I also know I got to bridge the tibia here, so incredibly, he's going to kick out. If I don't bridge the tibia, he'll break down every time, because the front bottom is the only problem that I'm concerned about on these things. Everywhere else, they pretty much can't hurt themselves. Yeah, yeah, they're all custom. It's pretty much human engineering, really. They'll come in and it's all a little bit different, even though you get the same person, same type of thing. If he's a little bit more bow-legged, or if he's a little more knock-kneed, or he's a little bit more pronate in the foot, it's a whole different engineering problem.
So they blur between science and art.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, if you have a hip joint, then you have a hip joint, knee joint, ankle joint. If you do something to the ankle joint, it's going to affect the knee joint and the hip joint, so you're constantly adjusting. We do have a pyramid system that we use, which is pretty good. And it adjusts flexion, extension, abduction, adduction. Again, direct bone attachment is some of the emerging technologies are doing. They're actually put a stud on the bone. The bone forms around the stud, locks into the bone, and then you have an adapter attaches to that, and then you'll have a foot and pylon attached to that. Again, they're still under development on this. Again, anytime you have an open setup like that, you're always susceptible to infection and things like that. So until they solve a lot of that problems, it's kind of crude to do something like this. I've seen a lot of different things that they've done in the past. When I was at UCLA, they had a whole family of Krukenbergs, and basically that was very interesting because they don't do a prosthesis. They separate the radius and the ulna, and they make a claw. And they had a whole family come in with these claws. And it's kind of disturbing if you haven't seen it before. But what they do basically there is there was the children's amputee program there, and they were teaching them how to pick up quarters and whatever they could with these claws. But it was quite interesting how they paraded the whole family, and they all had Krukenbergs. Again, the Boston arm, again, 5 different axes, the ILM, 5 individually powered digits. All this stuff is really nice stuff. I'm not sure when it's going to get onto the market.
Well, the ILM stuff, I think, is commercially available, as far as I can tell.
Well, yeah, I think the only problem with this is I don't think any insurance company in the world is going to buy this stuff.
Yeah.
And if insurance companies are the people that are purchasing this is not going to happen probably anytime soon.
So
unfortunately,
there's the technology challenge, and then there's the insurance challenge.
And the insurance are lowballing. I mean, if basically what the insurance are going to be doing now, if you can't do something at the same price or cheaper, they're not going to want it, because everything else was fine before, it's fine now.
Yeah.
Which is sad, because there's so much technology and there's so much they could possibly do. Again, modern prosthetics devices. There's a picture of the ILM and all the different componentry. Again, all 5 digits are moving individually, which is quite different than what we've had before. You can see what Chuck was talking about before is the FlexFoot engineers formed their own company, and they made this design here. And this is the Renegade foot. And this is one foot that actually my Neil Perry actually played for San Jose State in with this type of foot. And it has a lot of action. The thing is very, very light. And just a couple series of carbon struts that grab and push it down and then propel it back up. The sea leg here, again, is a pretty good breakthrough within the last 10, 15 years. Basically, this is a programmable knee to where, in this particular leg, I think you can program it in three different ways. First of all, the way I do it with my patients is I say, pretend that you're walking with a girl in a stroller. Okay, you got to slow down your gait. Well, the knee recognizes a slow gait and it mimics the other leg, which is kind of nice. The second gait would say, take your normal step. And again, my people would take the normal step. We program that, and it would bring out that second gear. The third gear saying, that bus has just taken off. You know, pretend that you're trying to catch that bus and you got to get that bus. Well, all of a sudden your speed comes up. Again, that third speed, the knee recognizes it and it'll kick in to gear. So the C leg is a kind of a good breakthrough. Now, they also are coming out with this power knee that's self-programmable, which is another breakthrough that they're again working on. And that was by Osher. I'm not sure exactly how far they got on that, but I know that that design was out for a while. Challenges of the disabled. Again, I don't claim to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist or anything, but I have been dealing with disabled patients now for pretty close to 40 years. And I know some of the attitudes that go on and some of the socializing that do or does not go on. But I do want to cover some of this because I think it's important, especially in this type of class. And the first thing is what I find out with a lot of my disabled, again, this is not 100% of them, but this is quite a few of them. They always take on a passive approach, and they'll always come in and they'll be timid and everything. And what I try to do is encourage them to come out, be a little bit more sociable, talk more, ask more questions. There's never a stupid question, anything like that. Also, you got to understand the challenge of the disabled is their support. You know, they need support to be independent, or they need support to help their dependents. Anyway, this is a very tricky thing because the support people have to be special people. They really have to care, and they really want to make sure that the people that we're looking over upgrade themselves constantly on a daily basis, which is important for me. Again, the people's attitudes about the disabled is kind of discouraging. The fact that it can make disabled people's lives a lot more difficult if you act in a discriminatory way with them or in a prejudiced way with them. You know, I think that what happens when you do things like this, it could cause a snowball effect to where the disabled people now do not want to put forth as much effort as you'd like them to. A lot of times this will stagger them, it'll depress them, and what we try to do is try to get out of that snowball effect that can happen. Here are some of the ideas that I actually try to instill in my patients. When I do see them, I always tell them, okay, we got to set up some goals, short-range goals that can be easily reached. For example, when I first get an amputee and they come in a wheelchair, in a couple of weeks I'll tell them, look it, you know, that the wheelchair is okay and everything, but we want to see you come in a walker next time. And then when they do come in a walker, the thing you got to do is make sure that you recognize what they just did. Very important that when you tell them to do something and they follow up, they're very proud of what they're doing, and you should be very proud of what they're doing, and you really need to follow up on what they, on their accomplishment. Again, take the first steps, feel confident, visualize. A lot of times I'll tell my patient, okay, you're going to be getting up next week. I need you to go home. I need you to visualize that you're walking down the street and you're not having any problems and everything, and amazingly, this does help. I think the positive visualization will get you there. Again, focus on what you can do. Get rid of the past rejections and take the risk. Use a non-passive approach. Ask a lot of questions. Get involved. Don't let the environment get in your way. Get involved with the mainstream society just like everyone else. Enjoy the same life experiences as everyone else is. That's very, very important. Go out and do it. Just go out and do it. Understanding differences, too. I think people like myself and other people need to know that the people that are out there have more likes than differences in you. And let's focus more on the likes and less on the differences. But you also got to understand that these differences are very sensitive situations, and you've got to be very sensitive to the situation.
What role does the family members play in all this?
Well, hopefully they play a great deal because, again,
just like a rehab. You need the family, you need the medical professionals, you need the therapist, and you need everybody as one group, all pushing forward, all with the same thing, and that's each day trying to advance, each day trying to upgrade. There's got to be something out there to where I can improve every day. And even if it's something little, you can do it. It's very possible to do things like this.
And I very much try to get my patients fired up and give them short-range goals and give them things to do, because it's amazing what these people can do when you light a match to their rear.
Again, this is a story that I had at 2002 with San Jose State was playing Texas A&M. Safety cornerback, Neil Perry, got tackled on his way to tackling someone, broke his leg so severely that they tried to sit it on the field. Within 48 hours, he was at Stanford. To save his life, they had to remove his leg. So it was quite traumatic. He went through a couple different processes. Finally, I got a phone call from an orthopedic surgeon from San Jose State, and he said, you know, I have a football player out here, and he's having nothing but problems with his prosthesis. I'm wondering if you can give him a hand. And I said, yeah, I could have a look at it. So to make a long story short, me and Neil got a pretty good relationship. After a month or so with me to where I was solving his problems, he told me that he had a desire to go back out and play football. It took us about a year or so through rehab and healing up the problems he had in the past, but the next year he did play for San Jose State. He made a couple tackles. In fact, he was in the East-West Shrine game where he actually made a tackle, which was pretty exciting. Pretty exciting stuff. And anyway, he always wore on his sleeve, never give up, NGU, always on his sleeve. And, you know, that inspired him that every time that he thought he had a problem, he'd look at that, never give up, get right back out there and do it. So quite a remarkable story with Neil. In fact, he has inspired this guy right here. This guy's name is Evan. He called me. He was in Hawaii. He was on a bicycle, and a drunk driver hit him. Lost his leg. He said he thought he could be a professional skateboarder, wanted to get back and do that since he heard Neil's story. Again, he had a lot more problems than Neil. The fact that he has a rod in his femur, a lot of rehab for him, just completely messed up. Finally, after about a year, I got him going, got him into a prosthesis, and now he's doing skateboarding. He actually called me from Florida about a month ago, said he won an able body skateboard tournament there. 2 days ago, he called me and told me he was a U.S. Olympian and he's going into the Paralympics. I'm not sure what field he's doing, but this kid can do anything. I mean, you can see what he does here. You know, leg or no leg, he probably could do this. And I say the same thing about Neil when they say, well, how'd you do that? How'd you do that with Neil? I said, I probably could have turned that foot backwards and he probably would have done the same thing. I mean, sometimes these people just, they get it, you know. And with a little bit of inspiration and stuff, you can really get them going. And I tell you, the sky's the limit. Who would have thought that this 19-year-old kid from Hawaii who was a skateboarder would make the Olympics 3 or 4 years later with an amputation? Another little bit about my journeys. I do medical missions in the Philippines. I've been doing it since about 2004, 2005. And it's very exhilarating. If you've never done a medical mission, it's the most exhilarating thing in the world to do. You pay for your own trip to go up there. Everything else is pretty much taken care of by the nonprofit group. But what we usually do is see about 400 patients a day. We stay there for about 8-9 days, and we end up seeing maybe about 1,400-1,500 patients. I'm the only really human engineer out there, so I'm making the prosthetics, the arms and legs, the stroke braces, the trauma braces. But we have retired emergency room doctors that go with us, which is very nice. Physiatrists, physical therapist, infectious disease doctors, basically anybody who wants to come to volunteer comes. And anybody that volunteers usually got an excellent group. There's a reason why they're volunteering, and they're special people. Again, where we specifically go is Bohol. As you can see here, they're famous for their chocolate hills. These are actually the chocolate hills of Bohol. That's like the Golden Gate Bridge. You've seen it once. You've seen it twice. But anyway, it's gorgeous. And as you can see, it's paradise. It's very lush. The culture is very exciting. You can see these old boats coming down here. You can see them cutting open the coconuts and different fruit. They're very, very religious, very cultured. The kids are all in uniform. Every Monday, they all line up in front of the government building, and they all take roll, and they sing. They do the Pledge of Allegiance, and they all go back to their classrooms. So it's quite a culture to see. I enjoy just going up there in the morning just to watch the whole thing of what they do before school in the morning. The transportation is yet to be desired. This might be a reason why I do 85% of my trauma out here. Okay. This thing on the left is called what they call a jeepney, and they're pretty popular in the Philippines. They come from different sizes and ranges. They dress them up. This is probably the less colorful one I've ever seen there. Usually there are 800 colors on them. They're pretty good. Good transportation. The only problem when they get filled up, they put the kids on the top. Just one of those things, you know. The kids are expendable, and I see a lot of kids there. This thing here is pretty interesting. This is called the tricycle. Now, this is a motorcycle with a sidecar. This is the sidecar. All right. And so they put people in this, and they get a lot of accidents and stuff in here. This is quite the thrill ride, though. If you ever get in a tricycle ride, it's something you'll never forget. In fact, these motorcycles, which are about this size, you can see the outline of the motorcycle here. They actually put seven people on these motorcycles. They'll put one tall person in the front, one tall person in the back, and they'll stack the whole family in the middle. And then they transport. So amazing. You won't see a helmet out there at all. So all this thing is kind of crude. Again, third world country, but this is why they may have a little bit of trauma out there. You can see another popular thing besides the chocolate hills here are these Tasmanian monkeys that only are in Bohol. They're on preserves now, but you can see the eyes. These guys are only the size of Coke bottles, Coke cans. So they're very small. Their eyes are sometimes a third of their weight. But they're fun to go into the preserve and get pictures with and stuff. And that's what one of these doctors did here. Here's what you'll probably see on a medical mission. Usually when we'll drive up into our jeeps, as soon as we drive up, it could be some tents that they put up or it could be a freestanding building. But they'll literally line up hundreds deep. We'll do a nurse triage. The nurse will send them either to one of the doctors or myself, and then we'll go ahead and take care of them. And we will. One of our missions is to make sure that everybody wants to be seen and that jungle village gets seen that day. So it could be a long day for us, but very rewarding when you're done. Karaoke every night. Here's one of my people that, good story. This is my friend Howard, who was one of my first patients there. He was an electrician. He hit a hot wire with his arms, of course, lost both of his arms. Very sad story that a year after he lost his arms, he lost his wife. 6 months after he lost his wife, he lost his son, who was about 4 or 5 years old. Again, rheumatic fever, it's pretty bad out there sometimes. But in his case, he had a 4-year-old daughter who was his primary caregiver. So she was getting him dressed, taking care of all his personal business. And she was doing this for quite a time before I got to him. When we got there, we made him his arms, got him his hooks, and he is very independent now. His daughter no longer is primary caregiver. He's primary caregiver to his daughter. He's a very intelligent guy. He's my main guy when I'm out there. He does all my translating. If I have to write any documents, he writes it for me. If I do any technical work, he does it for me. I force him to do everything for me. One of the things I told him that if he came with me, that he'd have to go out and take care of another disabled person. And the disabled person he took care of, that was the agreement he'd have to do. So we have a snowball effect as far as disabled helping disabled. Eventually, I think in this town, we're going to have disabled help enabled. And I think we can get to that point. Again, a very, very courageous guy, does really good. I didn't see him for a year, came back. All his cables were broken, and he literally himself, with no hands, lined it with fish line. So he actually made his own cables out of fish line. So when I came the next time, I ripped it all apart and put the cables back in. But he had functional prosthetics with fish line that he made himself, which is pretty incredible. Here's another guy, Counselor Cafe. He's probably in his 80s. He's one of these guys, unfortunately, got hit by one of these jeepneys, completely trashed his leg. Couldn't walk for maybe 4 or 5 years, he said, till he got me. I put a clamshell fracture brace on him. He threw away his crutches, started dancing with his personnel, and came back to me and said, "I would die for you," which is probably the most incredible thing that anyone's ever said to me. It just took me back that someone would say that to you, is to say, you know what, I would die for you. I mean, that is how appreciative these people are, and that's why you keep going back.
You kind of touched on it in your other slide, as I was thinking that, is that when you're in these kind of various climates, do you have to take into account things like humidity, temperature, for your materials, what you're building?
Yes.
You mentioned the fact that the maintenance factor.
Yes. And so that's why, again, one of my jobs is when I do these medical missions is educate, so I don't have to go back as many times. And that's why Howard's there. He's actually formed a disabled group for me. And so the nice thing is when I go there, he'll go, Mike, we're going over here. Mike, we're going over here. Mike, this person doesn't have any arms. And so I'm kind of spoon-fed, which is nice because it makes my job go a lot quicker that I don't have to go out because he's done all that while I wasn't there. Okay, we get a lot of our medication from Amsterdam. We get a pennies on the dollar. Pretty good. We bring vitamins. We bring antibiotics. We bring high blood pressure medicine. Anything we can possibly bring. Toothbrushes, toothpaste. We do ear washes. We call car washes. So we get a lot of people trying to, you know, irrigate the kids' ears while we're doing it. This guy has a goiter. They don't have any iodine there, so naturally they develop a lot of goiters and stuff like that. If they had iodine in their salt, they wouldn't have these problems. Again, these kids live in the jungle. You can see the bugs and everything that can just eat them alive. And a lot of kids will come in like this, some of them down to the bone with cuts and scrapes and stuff. You never know what you're going to get. This particular girl here had no capacity to extend her elbows, flex her elbows. So she could not eat herself. She had to be fed. I did make her some flexion elbow splints so she could actually get to her mouth with food, but... again, you never know what you get, and some people that don't look really deformed, she has some very serious issues, the fact that she can't even straighten her elbows out, bend them out. Again, a lot of the stuff that I'm doing there is getting molds of these prosthetic patients. Again, you can see Howard on the side. I mean, he's always in all my pictures. He's always trying to help. If he's not helping, he's writing down stuff because he wants to learn so much about this stuff. And he's going to be a good one, too. I mean, anyone that can put fish lines in a bilateral upper extremity is quite incredible. But anyway, you can see I'm casting a below elbow here. Eventually, what I usually do is my process is cast once, come back and deliver the next time. So a lot of times I'll try to get my stuff fabricated here where I can do it a lot cheaper. But I do have a lot of prosthetic devices there. I have a lot of orthotic devices there. I've probably got tens of thousands of dollars worth of tools and equipment there that I have in a warehouse there down in the jungle, so it's really easy for me because each time I go, I bring more thousands of dollars worth of stuff that I can work on, and eventually I'll be able to do everything there, I'm hoping. Of course, we can't help everyone. But and that's a very important thing, even though that's kind of a corny picture and everything. When I first went, my first medical mission, there was a physiatrist there, and he basically said, Mike, you can't help everyone, because when I was like, light my hair on fire, let me start fixing people, and I started going after it. And he kept saying, you can't help everyone. Well, one time, and he saw the girl, this mom apparently came out of the jungle. She said she was walking 3 days with her baby, and she's wondering if the doctor would look at him. She said she fell out of a coconut tree. Well, how did the baby get in a coconut tree? Well, the mom probably climbed up the tree and probably dropped the baby is what we're guessing. Well, anyway, the baby was pretty severely retarded. And again, you got to see a mom who's been walking the jungle 3 days just so she can see a doctor, and the doctor turns and looks at her and says, your kid is severely disabled. You're probably going to be carrying her the rest of your life. I mean, that was the first time that I heard that we can't do it, you know, and it kind of hit me a little bit, the fact that you want to help everyone, but you really can't tell them you can help them unless you can. You really can't tell them that you're going to deliver something unless you can, because these people will wait their years for you to come back on the hope that you're going to come back and give them this. So, again, pretty emotional stuff, pretty impressionable stuff, and very invigorating for the person doing it. There's nothing like it. I can't even explain it. I just want to thank you guys for giving me the opportunity again to talk to you. If you ever need to contact me, that's all the information I have. And I'm a wealth for information as far as human engineering. If any of your family members or friends or relatives or anybody has any problems, you know, I want to help everybody. I know I can't, but I sure would like to.
Let's thank Mike for that.
Yes.
And a great need, but you're not going to see me anytime soon there.
Yeah.
There's too much government, too much politics. If they put me there, I'd probably be in a waiting area for probably weeks. And you know, my whole job was when I get somewhere, I need to work. I need to work 16 hours a day until everyone's done, but I need to work. And for me to be waiting for them to tell me where I need to go would drive me nuts. I need to go and I need to work. And until they get to that, it's probably going to be years away. I probably won't go there. There's too much politics, too much government for me. And I need to do medical. I mean, I'm geared to fix, and I can't fix when they're going to hold me.
Yeah, there was a comment on the news that it's going to be a town of amputees,
yeah,
basically, after a while. So
yeah,
a lot of
that's sad because I'd love to live there and I'd help, and I'd like to help them every day. But, you know, I need to get through the crap, so to speak. You know?
Absolutely.
You know, my business is to fix people and period. Yeah. I mean, you know, like a good example is we tried several different places in the Philippines. A lot of these places wanted to charge us to go to their barangay, yeah. And then we're saying, we're non-profit, we're bringing a ton of medicine, these guys are going to make arms and legs, and all our doctors are going to treat you. Why would you want money from us? And it was incredible that we almost gave up until while we were on a plane flight back, the vice president of Mills Peninsula Medical Group, who owns Philos Health, is the group I go with, they said he met a Filipino on the airplane and said, you got to meet this mayor in Hagda. He's different than the rest, and this guy is. He's very charismatic. He makes things happen for his people. He's all about helping his people. And, you know, a lot of politicians aren't like that. You know, you think and you hope, but, you know, there's a lot less of that than you'd want. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.